Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back, and I'm only going to be saying that I think three more times because Movie Buff Specialist is going bye-bye, so get ready for that. I'm not going to tell you all what the new name is, but if you go hunt down around YouTube, you'll find it. But Movie Buff Specialist, now that this channel is becoming not specifically a Survivor-related channel and it's going to branch out into other things, Buff doesn't matter anymore. So we're going to be changing up the name, and it's going to sound nicer. It's going to sound cleaner, so I'm excited for that. But we're back. And we have Ant-Man and the Wasp and Godzilla minus one. And I had a good week. I know some people won't necessarily agree because Ant-Man and the Wasp isn't very popular, but I enjoyed Ant-Man and the Wasp. I'll admit it. I can't believe I'm saying it. I gave it 3 stars, and John texted me about 4 seconds after my review posted to say, I can't believe you liked it that much. I liked it. I dug it. I was into it. All about it. So here we are. Talking about Ant-Man and the Wasp and Godzilla minus one, which is better than 3 stars. So we'll talk about that in a bit. What do you got for me?
What do I got for you?
Yeah.
I have been hyped for Godzilla minus one since I found out it was being made. I'm a pretty big Godzilla fan. I love Godzilla movies. Wow, this movie surpassed every expectation I had of it.
Yeah, it had no business being as good as it was. And my review for it, I want to just read off my review because it really is how I felt. And hopefully me saying it out loud makes it sound better. But whether your movie is about Godzilla, the effects of war on those who suffered its worst consequences, or both, story and character are the most important things. This movie knocked it out of the park on all levels and left me way more emotionally drained than any other monster movie ever has. Well done. And I don't know how much more I can say about this movie than that, because I was devastated for half of this movie. And Godzilla's presence in this movie was well earned. And it wasn't just thrown in for the fact that Godzilla was a monster. There were reasons behind it. And even though we don't know what the hell is Godzilla, he's some creature that was awakened because of the atomic bomb. But God, the way that they decided to make this story about a kamikaze pilot dealing with the guilt and grief and the lack of like any type of self confidence or whatever, I can't think of the right word. What a brilliant decision, because it just makes for an absolutely brutal, brutal movie. This isn't a Godzilla movie. This is a post-traumatic stress movie. It's an incredible movie.
Yeah. It's a massive investigation into just Japan following World War II and the consequences of it. Obviously, like the time that it's set right after World War II. And it has this large thought. It has this like beautiful message throughout the movie about the value of life and how you shouldn't feel ashamed for not throwing it away in the war. It has these intricate, like, relationships between all these characters. It's built from the characters up, and I think that's the most important thing with this movie, because I think a lot of people think Godzilla and we think of, you know, the later Showa era films where Godzilla is just like the main character of the movie stomping around fighting monsters, whatever, or they're thinking of like the American Godzilla movies where, you know, there's really poorly written characters, and instead we have this beautiful film about just guilt and trying to exist one day at a time, and a man who loses everything and has to like come to terms with that. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's wild, and like it really brings to light the whole idea of the kamikaze pilot in general. This was something that, you know, we as Americans, you'll hear people say, oh, kamikaze, you know, whenever, you know, they say it at sporting events, they say it like that. And it's synonymous with, you know, just reckless abandon of you're going to do whatever. But kamikaze pilots were literally flying planes loaded with explosives, knowing that they were going to die, but they were going to die honorably for Japan. And this was really what the biggest problem, you know, and I'm saying this from an American point of view, so take it with a grain of salt, but that was kind of the biggest problem with the end of World War II, right? It was that Japan felt it was not honorable to just give up and give away so much of their culture and what they were. They were saying it's more honorable to die than to go down in defeat. Like, they saw that as cowardice. And so to set this movie with that same idea, but have it about a kamikaze pilot who is landing and there's nothing wrong with this plane, but he's trying to pretend there is, because he doesn't want to just kill himself because he does value his own life, and have people look at him as a coward, right? He comes back and the first thing he sees when he gets back to his absolutely destroyed village is his neighbor telling him how pathetic and all of that. And he's a disgrace, but the alternative is just dying. And I think there's a line in there about, you know, they tell you to die honorably, but it's a lie. And it is a lie. Mm. It's complete nonsense. Life has meaning. Life has value. And, you know, the fact that then he realizes as this movie goes on, and I really won't spoil the end, but he realizes as this movie goes on that there's no way to kill Godzilla except for by going through with a kamikaze run. It's just an unbelievably powerful through line in story. And it gives me chills thinking about it. And while I was in the theater, I could not believe that I was watching a Godzilla movie the entire time. I really couldn't.
Yeah. I mean, I was probably crying for like 20 minutes of this movie. It was so emotionally jarring and so emotionally just like impactful. It's because it worked on these like small character things. And then like, we're spending so much time with Koichi and like learning about him. We see his fear. And even when he's talking to the mechanic at the very beginning of the film, the mechanic's like, no, there should be more people like you. And then the mechanic immediately says, okay, now go in your plane and shoot Godzilla with your gun so the rest of us can survive.
Yeah.
Like it's fascinating to see how fast some of these characters turn. But then we have Koichi just living with that guilt of everyone dying because he was too, in his mind, too cowardly to do anything about it, despite the fact that he knew it wouldn't do anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the reason why I'm muted and got rid of my screen there is because I wanted to grab my criterion of the human condition, which is right behind me, but you know, whatever. So if you can see this, the human condition, I haven't watched part three yet. I've only watched the first two parts, but if you get a chance, watch this. It's 574 minutes, but it's separated into three different movies. They were released at different times and everything. So they count it on here as one big movie, but it's not. But if you were into this Godzilla movie, check out The Human Condition. It's from 1959 and 60 and 61 or something. I think those were the 3 years that the movies came out. But it kind of looks at the same things that this movie is looking at. It's looking at honor and doing the right thing and how constantly doing the right thing, you're being shamed or you're being put behind the eight ball over and over and over again by this war machine that really doesn't make sense. And somehow this movie is probably one of the greatest, this series. I mean, I've watched the first two. I gave them both 4 stars and they're absolutely unbelievable. And I can't wait to watch part three. And I'm sure one of them will end up in my next iteration of my top 100. But you expect that from a movie called The Human Condition by Masaki Kobayashi. You don't expect that from a movie called Godzilla Minus One. And seriously, as I'm watching Godzilla Minus One, I'm like, this guy was taking inspiration from The Human Condition while he was doing this. There's no doubt in my mind he was taking inspiration from The Human Condition while he was making Godzilla Minus One. And when you are starting to pull from that era of Japanese cinema, you are doing something right. And it's just so impressive what this movie was able to accomplish. When Godzilla first came on, I said, oh, okay, here we go. But then when he can't shoot the gun, when he can't make that moment happen and all those people die because of him, the guilt and the shame that he feels because of that is the driving point of this entire movie. And what I love about Godzilla, how this one does it, and it harkens back to the original Godzilla, the original 1950s one. It harkens back to that of Godzilla was always a metaphor for the atomic bomb. Always. That got lost over time. But this movie establishes how similar Godzilla is to the atomic bomb. The sheer destruction we see in Ginza and things like that. Though there's no way to stop it, the warships and everything just getting decimated over and over and over again. It's horrible. And you can see why they're doing it, because you know, you could sit there and say, oh, well, why do they have to have this monster? because it's almost unbelievable, right? But in the 1940s, the Japanese were looking at the atomic bomb and the destruction that it created and everything that happened as unbelievable. It was worse than a monster. It was unreal, the destruction that it caused. And so to just do that with Godzilla and go back to the roots, and I think improve upon the roots. And I watched the original Godzilla not too long ago. And I also gave that 4 stars. But I think that this really does improve upon that movie.
I think the big, this is the movie they wanted to make in 1954, but they weren't able to make.
Yeah.
This is, it's not, and not just from a technical standpoint, but from like a narrative standpoint, and from like, because obvious, like the reason Godzilla as a movie exists is because you couldn't make a movie about the war.
Yeah.
In Japan. Like you couldn't make this movie in Japan about the atomic, like the use of atomic weapons and stuff, because of, I mean, American occupation in the country, things like that, right? Mm-hmm. Now, 70 years later, I guess it's actually technically 69 years later, we get this. And it's just, it's really wild that in a year where Oppenheimer comes out, mm-hmm. Godzilla is still the best movie about an atomic bomb.
Yeah, and I'm surprised with all the critics awards and gold, you know, Golden Globe nominations and things like that. I'm surprised Godzilla Minus One wasn't showing up on lists. I think it came up,
it showed up in a couple of them.
It came up in a few of the foreign language, you know, mm-hmm. ones, but it wasn't showing up for Best Picture the way I thought it might, because this is a great movie. I mean, there's no exaggeration. I'm not a monster movie fan. You know, I'm not somebody who's going to sit there and say, oh man, I got to go and watch every Godzilla, or I got to go watch everything like this. I'm snobby as hell. And when I sat down to watch this, I said, yeah, the only friend who had seen it other than you was my buddy Scott, who is a massive Godzilla fan, owns all of the Showa movies and everything like that. Yeah. And every time I say something in a chat where he just doesn't have any response, he'll send the GIF of Godzilla drop kicking Mecha Godzilla or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And those movies are just silly, but I never grew up with those. It didn't matter to me. And he was saying how amazing it was. He went to a pre-screening of it. I mean, he was so into it. And I was like, okay, let me see. And I sat down and I watched it, and I didn't look at your review, and I didn't look at Steve's review, who, you know, is somebody who we both follow on Letterboxd. And I just sat down and I watched the movie. And from that opening shot and that opening sequence where the plane lands on the island, I was like, we are in the hands of a director who knows that they are making a movie that is bigger than Godzilla, but it has Godzilla in the title. And we were. And he never lets up the entire movie, and it is devastating. And it, even its look at family in Japan after this time, mm-hmm. and how like culture got in the way of things. They all think that they get married, they don't get married, and you see the way they raise the child because the child's not even theirs, and how Shikishima feels like so guilty because it's not his kid. And he keeps telling her, "It's not, you're not my daughter." It's devastating, but at the same time, you understand. With the guilt and the shame, and in a culture where honor means so much, you don't want her to have a father that is, you know, horrible or pathetic or just not, you know, doing what was meant, was asked of him.
And I also, I love how the, how Yamazaki uses the family unit and like mm-hmm. this like makeshift family unit to demonstrate that Koichi isn't a dishonorable person and isn't the type of like, isn't this coward that he thinks he is. And it's not all when he like gets handed a baby in the market and just doesn't leave her. Yeah. And like, you know, that small sequence tells you everything you need to know about this character and what he's going to do. And then, I mean, you learn that Noriko is like still living with him as the years go on and everything. It's so fantastic because this is the type of storytelling that we just don't get in Western blockbusters anymore.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And I mean, you know, obviously Godzilla 98 is a better movie. There's no denying it. It's 100% better. And John would agree, and he can't convince me otherwise. But when you see a movie like this, you see the ridiculousness of Godzilla 98 and even the Godzilla with Bryan Cranston, or, you know, when they do Kong versus Godzilla. It's so ridiculous and it's such nonsense. And I get sometimes you need popcorn flicks. That's fine. You can have popcorn flicks. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, this started off as an allegory to the world, the end of World War II. And somewhere along the way, a bunch of studios thought, hey, we can make a whole bunch of money off of this. Let's do that. And good for them if that's how they wanted to make money. But this movie made a really good amount of money. Mm-hmm. And it was a incredibly well-made movie. I'm excited to see this again. In terms of, I've seen 23 movies that came out this year. This is my number two right now. I go The Holdovers, then this, then Killers of the Flower Moon.
This is my number two as well. I have it over The Holdovers.
What do you have at number one? Past Lives?
Past Lives.
Yeah.
But I've seen 49 movies that have come out this year, mm-hmm. and it is number two. It is just so – I felt this movie as I watched it there, as I sat there and I watched it. And it's one of those movie viewing experiences where you can tell the entire audience is just like in awe of what they're seeing on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, you really can. And it was – that's what made it so impressive, right? Like I live in a part of South Florida, and I talk about this all the time, where the moviegoers are normally awful. Like they can't focus, mm-hmm. they talk, they text, they do everything you're not supposed to do during a movie. And I went and saw this on what day did I see this? I saw this on Tuesday at like noon. And it was actually quite a bit of people there. I think now that we're getting to Christmas time, people are, you know, getting right. off or taking off or whatever. And there were quite a few people in there, young, old. Didn't matter. Nobody made a peep the entire movie. They didn't make a noise. I mean, every now and then there'd be a giggle here or there, but nobody made a freaking peep the whole movie. And it was like, okay, this is a subtitled movie that I'm seeing in a theater where you normally can't sit down and get anybody to shut up for 5 minutes in a row. And it was just, it was like, it was devastating. It's just such a devastating movie. And look, I am, I don't know if this will spark anything else. I mean, it looks like, you know, they're ending it being like, oh, sequel, sequel, sequel. I almost don't want it to. It feels like it's going to go away of the Planet of the Apes, right? Where like the first Planet of the Apes is iconic, has this great ending. It's really cool. And everything after that, it's just going to be okay. You know, like whatever. Doesn't really matter. And like, I don't think you'd get Shikishima again. So it would have to be like, it'd have to be what the reboot trilogy of Planet of the Apes did, where then you found a way to make more compelling characters who also had stuff to do with this. So yeah, I'm really into it.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of not making a peep, the scene in this movie that is absolute silence is one of the best uses of absolute silence I've ever seen in a film.
Oh yeah, the absolute silence is great,
and because it comes out of nowhere, and you're just like, oh my God, you can feel everything that's happening in that moment. It is phenomenal. And like, that's the level of filmmaking that went into this movie. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we're talking about how successful it is. This movie was supposed to run for a single week in select theaters.
Yeah. In the US, that was it. And instead it was number two at the box office or number three at the box office this last weekend.
Yeah.
And was it number one its first weekend or number two?
I think it was number two its first weekend, but it made, what was it, 11 million domestic in that first weekend, which is the largest opening for a Japanese live action film in history.
Yeah, let me see here. So it was number three at US box office because you had the Beyonce movie, then the Hunger Games, right. then Godzilla. So it was number three, but this past weekend, I think it maintained number three. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so The Boy and the Heron actually became number one. Hunger Games was two. Godzilla was three because Renaissance, I mean, the Beyonce movie was never going to last. That was trying to build off of the success of the Taylor Swift movie. And it wasn't going to have the same legs. So that movie made $21 million opening weekend and then came out and made $5 million this past weekend. So Godzilla minus one has almost caught up to it. And I think with the word of mouth on this movie and the fact that it's Godzilla, I think people are going to go see it. I think the only thing that's really going to stop people from seeing this is the fact that it's subtitled. And in the US, subtitles don't fly as well as non-subtitled movies. It's just a fact. And so I think that is going to prevent some people from going to see it. But I could be wrong because today, the top two movies in the US are The Boy and the Heron and Godzilla Minus One. Or this was for Wednesday because today, obviously, Wonka gets released or movies get
That's
released.
That's wild.
Yeah, that they both beat the Hunger Games on Wednesday.
That like two Japanese language films can be up there. And I get it. Like The Boy and the Heron has the English dub and everything like that with like a stellar cast. But to think that like these two Japanese movies are doing this well right now, it's phenomenal to see. And I mean, this just opens up so much for what we can see from film moving forward in these theaters. Like when we have these like hundreds of million dollar movies flopping all the time, and you have this $15 million movie coming out, not even $15 million. Like, there are now reports that it was less than $15 million budget on this movie. And it's, like, garnishing this much attention and this much praise. Like, I've seen articles this week saying this is the type of movie that might save movie theaters.
Yeah, which is insane. That's so hard to believe. It's so hard to believe, but that's what's happening, because they need, sometimes they need these lesser movies to be able to keep them afloat. You need to have hits that aren't just massive movies, because those massive movies have more expensive distribution rights and everything like that. So you need to have these smaller movies be successful. And just to put this in perspective, right? Because we talk about it worldwide, Godzilla has made $58 million. Wish, the Disney animated movie that came out on Thanksgiving weekend, has made $107 million. So Godzilla Minus One has made $49 million less than Wish. And its widest release was 2,300 theaters, whereas Wish had 3,900 in the U.S.
Yeah.
It's not even close. It's crazy how successful that is for a movie. 13 days compared to 22, that might not sound like a lot, but there's nothing behind Godzilla Minus One. Godzilla Minus One was not meant to be this successful. But if you make a movie this good, people will find it, especially when it has, oh, I just switched us. Especially when it has crazy IP attached to it. That's always going to happen.
You know who probably is really hyped at how much hype is around this movie? Is Legendary. Yeah. Because they have a Godzilla movie coming out next year, and it is going to look so bad compared to this movie.
Yeah, so they're excited because it'll get people happy for Godzilla, but it is not going to be nearly as good as this movie, unfortunately.
No. And I think like I think that is a big thing, is like this movie goes to show why American Godzilla movies aren't successful. And like, yeah, they're successful, like people go out and see them because they're Godzilla. And Godzilla is
It might not seem like it made a whole bunch of money.
Godzilla is a huge IP, and people swear by this franchise. Mm-hmm. There are like 36 movies in this franchise now, and people swear by them. And it's just Americans don't grasp the allegory of a Godzilla movie, right? Like, obviously, like film viewers do, but from like a studio standpoint, they don't grasp the what's necessary to put into this movie in order to make it resonate with people. And that's what I think this movie especially really does well. This feels like a question of what was the point of World War II?
Yeah.
And there's the doctor's speech. When he is talking about the fact that they built planes without ejector seats and then asked people to fly them into boats.
Like all they had to do was build an ejector seat. And now the kamikaze pilots are crashing planes into boats, but they're getting out.
Like it's just wild. Like that is an idea that just escaped them. And like, it didn't fit with their honor in their society and stuff. And to see this movie talk about it, and like this idea of living and this idea of moving on and working through things and just making sure you're alive is so beautiful and so poignant. It just feels like something that we could never get out of an American blockbuster.
I agree. I mean, we will see what ends up happening with this new one that comes out. I mean, if you look at like Godzilla versus Kong, it was nonsense. And honestly, those movies aren't making that much money in the US. They're making money internationally. But in the US, they're not making much money because people, I mean, even the Godzilla 98, it was $130 million budget and it made $136 million in the US. It made like $500 million domestically or something crazy like that. But it was a total disaster not a disaster in the US, but it wasn't good. It made $379 million worldwide. So it made money. Like, there's no denying that one made money. But it didn't make as much in the US, and I think audiences gave up on it. And right now, like, I'm not somebody who's dying to go watch a Godzilla movie. I haven't seen Shin Godzilla, which I probably will go watch now, because of this one, and like, it, you know, restores it. But when a Godzilla movie, when I saw the first trailer for this, I said, "Oh, that's cool. Why are we doing a Godzilla movie? I don't understand." Now I understand.
Yeah, it's because there's a story to tell there, and I think another one of the points of this movie that I really appreciate is you look at these like outskirts of Tokyo and how run down and how like devastated they are. It almost feels post-apocalyptic.
Yeah.
And then like you're sitting there and you're like, this is actually how it was.
Yeah. I think that's huge. Yeah.
Yeah. It brings this weight to everything and it makes you realize like, this is horrible. Mm-hmm. This is the outcome of a horrible, horrible conflict. And we in North America, we see it from our side. We don't get to see this Japanese perspective that often, except through film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so devastating to look at and think, this is what our scariest fiction is written about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, especially at the time, right? Like, I know there's footage and there's images and stuff like that, but it wasn't like the world was as small as it is today. People weren't flying to Japan and going to Japan on vacations and things like that to the extent that people do nowadays. I mean, now you can go to any country, you know, any country that you can fly to, you can go to and you can go on a vacation there, and there will be positive things for you to experience in that culture and in that place. People weren't doing that. So really, the people weren't seeing the absolute devastation of World War II any clearer than the Japanese were. The Japanese were seeing it to its most insane extent. And so that for me is, you know, that's what makes this so devastating, honestly. And yeah, like, and you're right. It is. It looks like an apocalyptic movie. And the scary part is that it's not.
Yeah. And there's like little nuances in the film. Like the small, tiny hints at like the American occupation of Japan. Something like when Noriko is like going to work, and she's dressed in like a more American garb. It's so subtle, but for those who know about it, it hits so hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, this is a must watch. And like I said, we try to avoid getting too much into the story and into like the background. And, you know, we give the setup, but we were trying not to give like the details of what actually happens. But the way this movie unfolds and the side characters and the way that they put real stuff into the movie when they're going to get rid of the bombs and the mines and things like that in the ocean. It's really, really powerful because you saw what a desperate state Japan was in at this time, and they just nailed it. I mean, they just nailed it. And I can't wait to see. I haven't seen any other movie by Takashi Yamazaki. It doesn't seem like there's anything that I'd be interested in, but I'm very excited to see what his next movie will be, because I'm guaranteeing he's going to get a nice deal on something, Netflix or something. And it's actually probably going to be worth watching. Like, you know, like it's not just going to be like a Netflix movie. That's a Netflix movie. I think it's going to be something that's definitely worth watching.
Yeah, I agree. I'm very excited to see what he can do now that he has this reputation that came with making this movie.
Mm-hmm. All right. You want to move on?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Ant-Man and the Wasp 2018, the best Ant-Man movie I have ever seen in my entire life.
Really?
Well, yeah, because I like it more than the first one. And those are the only two I've seen. So I ended up ranking this right now, John. You ready? Number seven of my Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. We are now 20 movies in, and Ant-Man the Wasp is number seven. And you know what? No, it doesn't make sense in the order of the stories that they're telling. No, it shouldn't have come after Avengers Infinity War, and I said that last week. No, I really don't care about Ant-Man or the Wasp or the story that is taking place. Like, it doesn't make a difference to the bigger world of this MCU. But I don't like the MCU all that much. I have tended to like the standalone movies a lot more than the MCU movies. The Avengers movies are my number 20, my number 18, and my number 15 right now. And the movies that go over the top with trying to infiltrate, you know, all of those, all the other characters into the movies, I don't have ranked very high except for Civil War, which I have at number 4. But that's because I just like Captain America. Yeah. I watched this. I was thoroughly entertained the entire time. I was laughing to myself a lot that it had nothing to do with Infinity War, despite the fact that at the end they have them disappear. But I was into it. I liked it. Maybe I just really like Paul Rudd. Maybe Paul Rudd just has enough charisma to keep me going. But I enjoyed this movie, and I gave it a resounding 3 stars.
Yeah, it's higher than I rated. I only gave it 2.5. It's sitting at number 11 for me right now. I do enjoy it, though. And I remember the first time I saw it not digging it that much. But when I rewatched it earlier this year, when the latest Ant-Man movie came out, I remember being like, huh, this is better than I remember it being. And I don't know what it is either. I don't know if I can really explain what makes this so enjoyable. Maybe it is the fact that it is this standalone story in what's going on. It's different. There's like pretty much no like big bad in this movie.
Yeah, there's no, that's the big downside of this movie, I will say, and that's what keeps it from being higher than a 3-star movie, is there's no villain.
But I think that's I almost lean the other way. I think the problem is there are like minor antagonists, and it doesn't go one way or the other with either a big bad or no villain. Mm-hmm. I think you could have done either way, but because it was a superhero movie, you kind of had to have these characters. You had to throw in these characters from Marvel Comics that everyone's heard of. And you get those Easter eggs, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think Paul Rudd might actually be one of the best castings in the MCU. He is so entertaining to watch.
Yeah, he is. He is. And that carried the movie enough for me. And honestly, like, I like the whole cartooniness of him with his daughter, and he's under house arrest because of whatever and all that stuff. Now, this movie should have come out before Infinity War. Let's be real. Because
you can't have that end credit scene if you do that, though.
Yeah, you can. Because if you have that end credit scene, everybody goes, what the hell does that mean? You don't know what that means.
That's true.
You don't know what that means. And I actually think that if you set that up, people are going, wait, what happened to those three characters? Now you go in and you watch Infinity War, and then that happens at the end, and you go, oh my God, that's what happened to those three characters. That's crazy. I actually think it works better chronologically that way.
I've never actually thought of it that way.
You know what the reason was that it didn't come out in that order?
No.
Memorial Day weekend. That is the reason that they didn't come out.
Oh, so they
just Memorial Day weekend had to be Infinity War.
Infinity War, yeah.
Yep. And they had already put out Black Panther in February. They put out Infinity War in May, and I think this one was July, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that sounds correct.
Yeah, but you have to put out your big time movie over Memorial Day weekend, and that is ultimate. Right. That I think probably is the sole reason why Infinity War came out before this.
Interesting.
Because honestly, what they could have done at the end of Infinity War, I know like you have the Captain Marvel scene and everything like that, but that is setting up Captain Marvel. That's not setting up Ant-Man and the Wasp. So you could have had the first post-credit scene be Paul Rudd going into whatever and being like, come on guys, pull me out. And then they all turn to dust if you didn't want to have that scene at the end of Ant-Man and the Wasp. And then you go and you have the Captain Marvel one as your last one, as like your, we have hope, you know, but they didn't go that route.
Yeah. That's a good thought.
Yeah. I can write sometimes. Crazy. I can be a storyteller.
Yeah. This movie though, it's really, I do agree with you. It's weird that there's no primary antagonist and that we get these like minor characters there, because really the antagonist of this movie is more this nature element of like, can we get to the quantum realm to pull Janet out and save her? And that's what I would have preferred. I think I would have preferred if they just went like straight like science thriller with this movie, and it's more like this race against the elements of like going, like figuring out how to get in there and stuff. I'm not talking like, hey, make this Primer, don't do that, obviously that would not fly, but I don't know, something like Fantastic Voyage. I think works in this situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I never saw Fantastic Voyage, though.
Well, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah. So I can't even comment on that one, you know?
Sure. But like, even if we, let's equate it to more of like a spacey movie then, right? Like something like, even like Interstellar, like the way that that is framed instead might work better for this.
Mm-hmm. But then does it get too heady for audiences? Like, you know, like, cause you're talking Marvel. So it probably does, right?
I imagine that's probably why we don't get that movie. Because yeah. I think that's the logical way of making this movie, is to make it more about like the science behind it. But it felt like they were too scared to investigate it.
Yeah, because now that you start to nitpick it that way, if you really think about the plot of this movie, it's here's the setup. Now we're going to waste your time for an hour and 40 minutes until we do exactly what we said we were going to do in the first 5 minutes. And it almost would have been better off if they just got Michelle Pfeiffer early on. And then Michelle Pfeiffer is fighting with them, or if they go into that quantum world, which I know in Quantumania, it's going to be a disaster. And I'm going to hate that movie.
We'll talk about that later.
Yeah. But like, or they go in there and then they have to fight and do whatever there. But to keep Michelle Pfeiffer in the background and, oh, is she going to show up? Is she not? There's an entanglement. You know exactly where that story is going the entire time. I think maybe the reason why it didn't bother me so much and why it wasn't like clinging in my brain is because maybe, you know what, like for me, I'm just so used to knowing where these movies are going to go at this point that if I'm enjoying the ride, that's all I need for me to give it at least 2.5 stars. And I was enjoying the ride on this one. And now that I've talked to you, you know, you're starting to ruin the ride a little bit, but it is my lowest ranked 3-star movie. So there is a chance I could just drop it down to 2.5 and be totally content with my life's decisions.
Right. I'm sorry to ruin the ride. But it is a popcorn flick. And like, I feel like it's been a while since we've watched one of these MCU movies and been like, this is a good popcorn flick.
Yeah, I like Guardians 2 that way, but I know you don't. But that's the one for me that like I say, okay, that's a good popcorn flick. Because let me look at them in the order again.
I actually think Ant-Man's the last time I felt that way.
Yeah, so Guardians 2, and then you have Spider-Man Homecoming. Spider-Man Homecoming is kind of a fun.
Yeah, I guess that one. Yeah.
That's a fun, like, you know, popcorn type flick. And then it's Thor Ragnarok, Black Panther, Infinity War. Infinity War is a popcorn flick, but Infinity War is a 2.5 hour trailer.
Yes.
You know, Wences Acosta just said, ooh, I came in during a movie podcast. Sweet. Stay, enjoy, listen. They're going to be coming out. They keep coming out every week, and Raptor 8415 said, hey guys, hi. But yeah, I feel like Infinity War was just a giant trailer. This one though, like, so if you look at these, right, you go Black Panther and then Infinity War, and Infinity War needed Black Panther to precede it because Black Panther is involved in it. The fight happens in Wakanda. Yeah. And then Ant-Man and the Wasp, Captain Marvel, Endgame. Ant-Man and the Wasp, it was like, we need to get another Ant-Man movie in there so that, you know, I guess Scott Lang being in the quantum world is going to have something to do with something. But it's like, okay, you got that in there. What was the reason for the timing? And that's what I always talk about with this franchise in general, is there's just so many movies and there's so many storylines. Yeah. And sometimes it doesn't always feel like it adds up. It doesn't feel like it makes sense. And Ant-Man and the Wasp, look, I can watch this as a standalone. And it doesn't bother me. I'm not so invested in the storyline that's overarching throughout the entire franchise that I care. But there is literally no reason for it to happen here. There just isn't.
Yeah, but I think that timelessness, like, other than like the post Civil War of it all and like the pre Endgame of it all, I think that's kind of nice though, having that like timelessness of like when it can happen in this timeline.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, but I'm saying, right? Like, I'm saying, like, you leave off on one of the biggest cliffhangers in a blockbuster ever. I mean, you're talking like you had the Snap, even though it's not as good. I mean, the Snap is up there with, you know, Luke and Leia and stuff staring out into the abyss after he gets his hand chopped off and you find out that Darth Vader's his father. And you have that type of cliffhanger, and then you're like, and here's Ant-Man and the Wasp, and they're doing silly things. And but again, I like the story. I also like, you know, I think Michael Pena, again, is great in these movies. I talked about that the first movie that we watched. I think he does a really good job. I could watch an endless amount of those scenes where he's talking and everybody's mouthing along as if they're doing his voice. I love that shit. But, yeah, I mean, that for me is where this movie goes. Now, if I was a huge MCU fan, I would hate this movie. I would absolutely hate it because this followed up Infinity War and you're wasting my time. I want to know what the hell's happening to everybody else. And you're going to hit me with this shit. Come on. That's a waste. So that's how I feel. That's how I feel about that.
Yeah, that's fair. I just feel like I complimented the first Ant-Man on this, but it feels like we get more relationships in this movie than we do in a lot of these other MCU movies. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, I know, I understand these interactions between these people. I understand what they want. And again, I love the depiction of this family unit that they have in this in this movie. I love the fact that we still get Scott's ex-wife and his
Bobby Cannavale's
new husband, right? Like, it's just like, there's a great family dynamic in this movie. Mm-hmm. And even the things about like Scott wanting to be partners with Hope and like the comment that Cassie makes about it and stuff. It's cute and endearing in a way. And it just feels like these are characters coming to terms with the fact that, you know, they've kind of betrayed each other a little bit, but like they betrayed each other's trust in doing these things. And like, they have to get over it. It feels like we actually have interpersonal conflict that is not driven by rockets being blasted at each other.
Yeah, exactly. No, and I agree with that. I think that the character development in this movie is actually very good. You know, I'm into it pretty much from start to finish. I think, you know, the Scott being on the outs with them and then feeling betrayed because he went to Germany and didn't tell them that was going to happen. And then even like the character with Lawrence Fishburne and the girl who's like flitting around through time. Those are good characters. Like they make sense in the story and their motivations are actually kind of clear. So yeah, there is a little bit more storytelling in this movie than in other movies. And that's maybe why I like this one more than a lot of the other ones in the MCU. Maybe I like it more because there is more of a story being told and it's based more around the characters than it is around, oh, wasn't that a really cool thing that yada, yada, yada did?
Yeah. It's just like, it's more contained and it feels like the MCU is scared to tell a contained story sometimes.
Yeah.
But when they do, it just feels like they resonate better.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. I do. What else can we talk about with this movie? Wentz has said, to be fair, the family dynamics have always been the strong points in the Marvel universe. I don't know if I agree with that, but I don't know what the strong point is. I just don't know if I agree with that.
Maybe that's coming later.
Maybe. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, I know in Black Widow, they all talk with Russian accents. That's got to count for something, right?
Family.
Family. Yeah.
Speaking of Russians, though.
Yeah, here you go. Hit me Russian. I knew I'd get you going on that.
I personally think the funniest ongoing joke in this entire movie is the Baba Yaga bit.
The Baba Yaga bit is very funny in this movie.
It's so funny. Especially if you know anything about Baba Yaga, because Baba Yaga is terrifying. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny when Ghost appears in like the office and he's just like, Baba Yaga. It just makes so much sense if you understand where that character is coming from.
Yeah. No, I did like that bit, and the recurring joke of it is very fun. And I like all those side characters in this. Like, I like those three guys, Michael Pena, and I can't remember the other, T.I., and then David something. He's got the craziest last name. But I really like those characters. And I think that's what sets this one apart. I feel like the Ant-Man movies are having the most fun, but they're not having fun at the expense of people who aren't so into the MCU. I feel like some of these movies, they're like, isn't that really cool because you like Spider-Man? These, I feel like it's having a good time anyway. With the constant building getting bigger, smaller, Scott gets so big that he passes out and he can't even stay up anymore. And you know, like just those little things, the visual cues, the visual humor in this movie, it's funny whether you're into the MCU or not. And I think you have to go that route when you're making a movie about Ant-Man, because who the hell cares about Ant-Man? Nobody cares about Ant-Man. But if you're going to make a movie about Ant-Man, you have to go all in on something. And I feel like they go in on the humor and like the chaotic, frenetic pace rather than explosions and stuff like that. But even while they're doing all that, they're keeping the characters in focus, Yeah. And you know them all really well. And maybe it's just because you have Michael Douglas and Evangeline Lilly and Paul Rudd and Michael Pena, who are all really good actors. And then you add in Bobby Cannavale, who, if you haven't watched Boardwalk Empire season 3, I think it is, it's one of the great villains. Jip Rossetti is just an unbelievable villain that Bobby Cannavale plays. And you have Judy Greer, who's always good. You have a lot of good actors, and they're not having to eat up so much camera time that it becomes exhausting.
Even if we look at like the smaller actors in this movie, I mean, we have Lawrence Fishburne, obviously. We have Walter Goggins, who we just don't get enough of in this movie.
Yep.
I agree with that. Like, I would have been totally content if Walter Goggins was actually just like a villain in this movie.
Yeah. And the problem with his is because you're not getting the, because you don't get anything extra from him, like, he feels like a half-assed villain. Where it's like, why couldn't there have been more to him that would have made this more worthwhile?
I mean, especially like, we know what he can bring. Like,
yeah,
everyone who's watched, what's that one with Timothy Oliphant?
Justified
knows what Walter Goggins can bring to a role like this. It's essentially like, it's set up to be a similar role, and we know he could easily do it. Even I really enjoy Tim Heidecker being the guy on the ferry.
Yeah, that cracked me up. I was not expecting to see Tim Heidecker in this movie.
Yeah. It's just one of those things where I was completely caught off guard. The role is so small. He literally is just talking about breaching whales. It's so funny.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that was good and very, very unexpected. What else was there? I'm trying to think of with those like bit parts. There's nobody else that really stands out.
What's his face? The FBI agent.
Yeah, what is his name?
I feel like I should know it.
I don't feel like I should know it because I feel like I've maybe seen him once, but
I mean, if you haven't watched Fresh Off the Boat, that's a funny show.
I have not
Randall watched Park Fresh is in it. It's Randall Park.
Randall Park, that's right. And yeah, Randall Park was just in what movie was he not just in something? I thought he was just in something that I had seen, but maybe not. But he was in Strays. He plays the voice of one of the dogs. Maybe that's what I understood from him. I mean, obviously I didn't see him, but maybe hearing him in that movie is why I had like the voice stuck in my head, because I haven't seen really anything with him in it, but I've definitely seen him.
Yeah. And he's just like another, I love that character. I love that interaction with like, I'll be seeing you later. Oh, I thought you meant for like dinner. It's like, wait, do you want to go out for dinner? Like, it just goes to show how different of an FBI character he is compared to these other like generic FBI characters we get in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. He was somebody, was it Wences here says he's amazing in WandaVision. And that is like one of his top credits is WandaVision. Mm-hmm. So I haven't watched WandaVision. I don't think I will watch WandaVision.
You probably won't. But we'll have to talk about it eventually because it is relevant to the plot of one of the upcoming movies.
I don't have to do nothing.
I'm just going to let you know when it becomes relevant. That's all.
When does it become relevant? Which movie?
Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness.
Well, guess what, John? I'm going to be a little confused watching Doctor Strange and the Multiverse.
You sure are.
Yeah, because yes, I am not. I am not giving in to what Disney and Marvel want me to do. And I'm not going to start watching TV shows and acting like I care. I just don't. Yeah. I just don't. I mean, enjoying this movie as much as I did should be a huge win for them. And they should just be content with the fact that I'm okay with that.
I also like that this movie does something different in its third act. I like that we don't have a like typical baddie showdown. I guess it is kind of the result of there not being a big baddie, but the fact that the end of this movie is really just a chase scene, I like that. It felt better. It felt like a better conclusion to this movie than having Scott Lang throw punches at people.
Yeah, it's a chase scene and Michael Douglas going to get Michelle Pfeiffer and them trying to come back out of whatever that is, you know. No, I think I agree with you. And it's kind of the benefit and the negative, right? Like, you have to take the good with the bad. I complain every time because every time we get to the fight scene at the end of these movies, it just feels like, oh, they're punching each other for the sake of punching each other. I know what's going to happen. But in this one, not having that, especially following up the Thanos one, it's an interesting decision to have your first movie post Thanos winning not include a big bad fight. You would think that that would be a priority to be like, hey, look, we got to remind people that the Avengers can still win, even though, okay, Ant-Man's not an Avenger, whatever. We have to remind them that these people can win. And instead they don't do that, and they don't have a big bad villain. And I wonder if part of the reason why they tried not to go with the big bad villain was because Thanos is such a massive villain, and they knew how big Thanos was going to be, and that Thanos was going to be, you know, in more than one movie. I wonder if that had something to do with this and their decision not to have it.
Yeah, I could see that being a thing. I also think they just wanted to tell this like smaller story, and they wanted us not to, because even like our villain in this, Walter Goggins' character is the biggest villain, I would say, the most villainous person in this movie. Whereas like Ghost is kind of like that sympathetic villain, which I mean, also they tried to do with Thanos, so maybe that's also part of it too. But
Ghost is way more sympathetic than Thanos, though.
Well, yeah, I mean, she was just in an accident and happens to be dying. Easy to sympathize with that.
Yeah. No, for sure. I am trying to, Wences is really trying to get me to watch WandaVision. Says it's great.
Yeah, I'll fill you in.
Says it's not like we're asking you to watch She-Hulk, which I will say, no matter what happens in my life, She-Hulk will never be viewed.
Okay.
It will never be viewed. That one I know for sure will not be viewed. I'm looking, I'm trying to look and see. I don't really have notes on Ant-Man and the Wasp because it was like a, it was just an action movie. So I don't really have like much more to say on it. So maybe there's like a different subject we could glance at for like 8 minutes. I don't know.
We have American blockbuster here. We just talked about Japanese blockbuster. Like, let's just compare.
Yeah.
The way that these movies are handled.
So much CGI. My God.
Yeah. So much. I actually found myself while watching this movie thinking, because I mean, it's the holiday season. I just watched Elf last week. You watched it a couple weeks ago. I was just like, man, how much better would this movie be if it just used forced perspective?
Yeah. Yeah. Some of the stuff you can't help it, right? But yeah, like there's one scene where Paul Rudd is the kid and they use a little bit. Do they use forced perspective there, or are they using CGI?
I don't think so. I think it's all CGI.
It's all CGI except for, I think, when they get in the van. I think that is forced perspective, and that looks good. Because honestly, he looks weird walking in the hood. It doesn't look like a normal child, and it also doesn't look like a man. I don't know what height he's supposed to be at that point. Because like he's walking around, and he's up to like the middle of everything, and then he gets in the van, which isn't that high off the ground, and he has to like crawl in. I don't understand what his height is supposed to be at that point.
Yeah, it was not really determined very well.
Yeah.
But forced perspective would have helped do that.
Yeah, because you're forcing me to understand that he's like 5'1" or, you know, or 4'2". But I had no idea what I was looking at.
Yeah, it just feels like there are these techniques that can make these movies better. Obviously there's CGI needed. But it felt like, you know, some of the car chase was CGI and stuff like that. It's like, is that necessary?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not. And there's definitely... there's definitely some in there. Sorry, I don't know why that's talking. There's definitely some in there, though, that is CGI, really, for no reason. I'm trying to think. Yeah, because in Godzilla Minus Zero, the only thing that felt like CGI was Godzilla. But the CGI is very good on Godzilla. Godzilla looks, like, menacing. It looks very good. I know, like, destroying the buildings and stuff like that is CGI. But whatever CGI team they used, it kind of looks better a lot of the time. And maybe that's just because it's less colorful and so it blends in a little bit better. But Godzilla Minus Zero feels like a more, a cleaner CGI movie, even though the budget was super small. Maybe that's because a lot of it is more practical.
Yeah. I think it's just sound stages. Like the thing that has been really playing at with these Marvel movies recently, the use of sound stages, where we were talking about it with Infinity War last week, where you can just tell nothing in the background is real.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially like, when they're in the quantum world.
Yeah. And like, that's the major difference, right? Is actual sets, and not just like the immediate sets, but the surrounding sets as well. That's what really immersed you in Godzilla.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wences asks, do we have a favorite Paul Rudd role? Mine personally is I Love You, Man. Do you have a favorite Paul Rudd role?
I don't know.
I do.
I can't think of anything off the top of my head that Paul Rudd's in.
I have one. What do you mean you can't think of anything off the top of your head that Paul Rudd's in?
Well, not that like he like really stands out much. I mean, like obviously, like he has like his minor roles and stuff, like in like Anchorman.
Yeah,
which is great.
Ooh. So you can think of movies he's in.
Yeah, apparently. I just don't know what I would say my favorite one is. Just give me a second to look, and like you can talk about yours now.
Wet Hot American Summer for sure.
Okay, sure. Yeah, like he's
Wet Hot American Summer, hands down. And I think I prefer him in the second one, like in the TV show to the movie, where he is just, you know, he is so over the top. Wet Hot American Summer for sure.
What do I like Paul Rudd in?
Nothing.
That's not true. I feel like I really like Paul Rudd. You know what? I prefer him when he's like doing his sketch comedy stuff with like Tim and Eric, in all honesty.
I mean, he was, and that's like why Wet Hot American Summer, he works so well. Yeah. Because Wet Hot American Summer, he is leaning more into the sketch element of things rather than his serious roles. And, you know, I mean, he's good. He's good in everything. I mean, This Is 40. Mm-hmm. He's good. What's the movie where they do the role, the LARPing? What's the movie with the LARPing with McLovin and Sean William Scott? He's good in that one too. He sings Beth by Kiss at the end. I literally can think of everything in that movie except for the name of it. I have just given you the most thorough description of a movie that I can't think of the name of I've ever given in my entire freaking life. What movie is that? Oh my God.
Role playing?
They LARP.
They LARP.
Oh my God. What is the name of that movie? Okay. I'm looking it up now. Okay, let's see. I mean, he's in This Is the End. We all know that.
Yeah.
And he's being a wallflower, he plays the teacher.
The teacher, which is great.
Yeah. He's great. Forgetting Sarah Marshall, he plays Chuck. That's a good one. Mm-hmm. Knocked Up. He's got the small role.
He's in The 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Yeah, he's got the small role models. That's the one.
Role models. I never saw that.
That's movie. David Wayne. David Wayne directed that, and David Wayne's the guy who did Wet Hot American Summer.
Hmm.
Yeah, role models. Here we go. Wences has finally threw it in there. Thank you.
He's an entertaining guy.
Yeah, he is. All right, let's ask this last question and then get out of here. Wences wants to know how we feel about Godzilla Minus Zero making dents in the American awards scene. It nominated for Best Foreign Film at Critics' Choice and is rumored talks for Academy Awards. I think it's the Japanese nominee for
The
Academy Awards. I think it got the Japanese thing. I'm not sure. I could be totally making this up, just assuming that they would do that, but
that's wild. That there was a new Hamaguchi movie that came out this year. There was another prolific Japanese director's movie came out this year. There was a Miyazaki movie that came out this year.
Yeah, but I think Boy and the Heron wound up getting nominated for animated, and they won't
put it in for sure.
Yeah, because it'll probably win animated this year, right? I would think.
What other animated movies came out this year?
Wish. Super Mario Brothers.
Oh,
which was more of a box office movie than anything.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think it'll win anything. I think it could get, if it's Japan's submission, it could definitely get nominated for best international film.
Mm-hmm.
It also helps that Past Lives is an American movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
So despite the fact that most of that movie's in Korean, it's still, like, it's not eligible for Best International Film.
Sorry for yawning in your face as you said that. Yeah, it has to be. Even though they changed it, it's funny because they changed it to international film instead of foreign language film.
Foreign language film, yeah.
But, like, I mean, I guess that makes more sense because you could speak a different language and be an American movie. But still.
I mean, a Canadian movie can be nominated for that category now.
Probably. Yeah, probably. I don't know. I don't know what they consider international.
I have so many questions now.
Because then couldn't the UK just clean up every year in that? Like, shouldn't
Well, Dunkirk... the UK has one nominated this year, don't they? Isn't the Zone of Interest?
Yeah, but the Academy Awards haven't done that yet. I don't know if that counts for the Academy Awards or just the Golden Globes are nonsense. They just do whatever they want.
Yeah.
They're now nominating six people for everything. I don't know.
That was weird.
Yeah. Since when? All right. Let's wrap this thing up. Next week, we are going to be going and doing. What is the next Marvel movie? Captain Marvel. Yes. So we're going to be doing Captain Marvel and we're going to be doing Wonka. It feels like Wonka is the necessity for next week. It's coming out in a wide release and it's going to be the movie everybody's talking about. It's playing every 30 minutes here. Godzilla was not an easy one to get in for me. It was every 3 hours on the hour. It was tough. But Wonka should be okay. I'm excited to watch it. It can't be worse than the Tim Burton one and it can't be better than the Gene Wilder one. So my expectations are very middle.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're very middle. Wences says Captain Marvel means cringe is incoming. Is that how you feel, John?
No, I feel that movie gets a bad rap. I don't think it's great, but I don't think it's terrible.
I'll be the judge of that.
We get Jude Law.
That doesn't mean anything at this point. These movies get everybody, and I go, okay.
They do.
Yeah, like, whatever.
All right. I haven't seen it. I haven't seen Captain Marvel since it came out, so it'll be interesting to revisit it.
We'll see. So that's it, everybody. Next Thursday, again, it'll probably be 8 o'clock though next week. So tune in then. And thank you all for listening. Excited to see Wonka, the first of the holiday movies, I guess, that's coming out this year. Here we go. Bye.